Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Written with equal parts candor and lyricism, the writer Pam Houston illuminates the interconnected histories of abortion in the United States and in her own life during the decades when Roe v. Wade was the law of the land. And she guides us through the shifting landscapes of politics, the law, and self-determination in a country where access to medical care and the power to determine your own destiny are increasingly, and once again, she says, dependent on geography and circumstance. We're going to talk with Pam Houston about her new book, Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. It's out from Torrey House Press. Pam Houston is the author of Airmail, Deep Creek, Contents May Have Shifted, Cowboys Are My Weakness, among others. She teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts Creative Writing MFA program and is professor of English at UC Davis and co-founder and creative director of the literary nonprofit Writing by Writers. She lives at 9,000 feet above sea level near the headwaters of the Rio Grande. Pam Houston, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much. I'm always happy to be on your show.
So this is Colorado, right? Southwestern Colorado?
That's where I am, yes.
Yeah.
Southwestern Colorado, Creed, Colorado.
9,000 feet. This is a homestead that you've written about this. Pretty rustic. Maybe still pretty rustic.
It's pretty rustic. I mean, I am connected to an electrical pole these days, which makes me feel a little more connected. But it is a homestead. I am the person who's lived on this 120 acres longer than anyone now except the original homesteader. And it's only been sold a couple of times. The homesteaders are buried up on the hill. You know, it's rustic and it's really pretty untouched, this acreage.
Yeah. One other little aside before we jump into this book. You have a fascination with Iceland. Icelandic, is it sheep? Icelandic
well,
something.
my fascination is with Icelandic horses, which my friends are calling my midlife crisis because I go and ride them very fast across rocky terrain a few times a year now. It's really become my obsession. I raise Icelandic sheep, which is a complete accident. It was before my love of Iceland got kindled. I rescued some sheep from a hoarding situation that needed a home. So I've had a little flock of Icelandic sheep here for years because, of course, at 9,000 feet, the climate is good for them up here. But I had my sheep before I ever fell in love with the country and the horses.
So I can't resist one more aside. Why Iceland? Why the fascination?
Well, it's really the horses. The horses are bossy and brave and true blue and low to the ground, which is good for my 62-year-old body. So if you fall off, you don't fall that far. But they really embody the Icelandic spirit. I love the people of Iceland. I love the landscape, the clean air, the clean food, the clean water. But those horses, I don't know if you know this, but they have been the breed has not been polluted or mixed in any way since like 800 when the Vikings brought the horses over. No other horses are allowed to go to Iceland. So they've kept the breed super pure and they're just the most, they want to be in communication all the time. You don't just sit on an Icelandic horse, you ride it. And I love that. I love that cross-species communication. And I mean, that's the real reason why I'm so obsessed with them. I like horses here too, and I ride, but those horses are special. And it's partly because of how the Icelanders have protected all the qualities they love about the breed, literally through the centuries.
So the new book, Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. Why this subject for the new book?
Well, it's a subject that's very important to me. Women's bodily autonomy is a subject that's super important to me, always has been. I was raised in a household where my body sort of belonged to my father. And I got out of that household and made a life that I love. And a lot of that is because I had choices about what to do with my own body. But the actual circumstance of writing the book is that I was with Kirsten Allen, who is the publisher of Torrey House. We were at an event for the book about the Gila Wilderness, first wildest Torrey House book that came out celebrating the 100-year anniversary of the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. And we were just waiting for our turn to speak. And I said, you know, what's funny? I just realized this was right after Dobbs came down, right after the end of Roe v. Wade, and we were screaming about it. And I said, you know what I realized? I realized my life corresponds exactly, my reproductive life corresponds exactly to the length of Roe v. Wade, because I did get my first period in 1973 in January. Like my reproductive life began with Roe. And Roe ended as I went fully into menopause. And I just thought that was like a fun fact. And Kirsten, in her way, said, you want to write a book about that? And I said, yeah, maybe I do. She said, can you write it before the 2024 election? I said, I think I can. And that's how it began.
Therein presented some difficulties. You write in your author's note that the landscape keeps, the political landscape keeps changing so fast. At a certain point, I guess you had to just say, okay, the book's done.
Completely. I mean, I kept making changes right up until we went to Galley's because things kept shifting. And then I finally just sort of threw up my hands and wrote that author's note and said, there's no way I can keep up. I have to stop sometime if this book's going to come out to try to make some small difference in the 2024 election. And, you know, just in the last 4 weeks, we've seen the landscape change so much. So I never could have anticipated that, but I think it's coming into a good, hopeful moment for women's reproductive rights, for sure.
I'm going to have you read a passage. This is a bit from chapter one. By the way, what you said, 60 chapters?
Yeah.
Why that number?
60 chapters, one for each completed year of my life. I knew the book was going to be a sort of collage or a montage of various things. There were going to be personal stories. There were going to be metaphors from nature for the way w mothers and women are treated in the world. There was going to be facts about the studies done by universities, about trap laws, about post-Roe care in states with abortion bans, about women who are turned away from abortion. There's going to be statistics on maternal mortality. There was going to be songs and poems. Like I wanted a lot of voices. I wanted the book to be multi-voiced on this subject. So it needed to have a structure that allowed for a lot of little pieces. And honestly, it was just kind of a middle of the night thought, okay, well, I've been alive. I've completed 60 years of my life, so there'll be 60 chapters, you know, because the book is kind of about lifespans. Lifespan of Roe, you know, lifespan of women. So that's how it came. It wasn't deep thinking, honestly. It was just a way to make a case for its kind of broken structure, basically.
Let me have you read from this first chapter. The chapter is called Lifespan of a Human Right.
Okay. For 49 years, 5 months, and 2 days, the United States Supreme Court protected a woman's right to have an abortion. In other words, it protected a woman's right to determine what happens inside her own body and in the long winding road of her future and in the shape of her one precious life in the case of unwanted pregnancy. It protected this right whether she was 12 years old and had been raped by her father or another male relative. Whether she was 22 and date raped after she'd had her cocktail drugged in a bar the first time she spent a summer interning at a nonprofit in a big city, whether she was 42 and happily married and already had 4 children and the family budget was stretched beyond manageability, whether she was dedicatedly single and entirely career focused and had thrilling, unprotected sex with strangers every chance she got. Those 49 years, 5 months, and 2 days happened to correspond almost exactly to the span of my reproductive life. I got my first period at 11 years old in January of 1973, the same month Jane Roe took her case against the state of Texas to the Supreme Court. As of last year, I am now, and only just now, fully in menopause. after what seemed like the longest perimenopausal decade in the history of the universe, a decade of joint aches, night sweats, and flashes of rage so intense, it was like 1 minute I was a woman and the next minute I was a cheetah. It was also a decade of coming to terms with myself. For my entire reproductive life, the government of the country of which I am a citizen, supported by the highest court in the land, protected my body sovereignty, which is more than they did for my mother, and which is more than they would do for my daughter, if I had one, which I do not, nor a son, because I did not want children. I never wanted children, and I was free to have an abortion, more than one. I was free to have the three abortions I needed over the course of my reproductive life, and did so, one in my 20s, one in my 30s, one at 41.
That's Pam Houston reading from her new book, Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. She's our guest for the hour today. So in your author's note, I'm going to quote you here. You say, a book's first purpose is to lead its writer into a place much more emotionally complicated, much more fraught, more entangled, more layered, more confusing than she had expected. It should always end with far more questions than answers. That's obviously how you feel about this book, I think, right? This is a very complicated subject anyway. You chose to be very, very open with your personal interaction with this subject.
I did. I mean, in general, I am an open person, you know, as a writer and as a person. You know, I grew up in a house full of secrets. I grew up in a house of don't tell your mother, don't tell your father, don't tell your teacher, don't tell the social worker, you know. And so I have found that telling is better, works out better for me. In this book in particular, you know, I knew I was in dangerous and difficult water, and I am imperfect. I had this realization after I'd agreed to write it, while I was first writing it, that I wasn't absolutely certain in my memory whether I had had two abortions or three. And that was a terrible moment of self-recognition. I was like, are you kidding? You know, all of the things the anti-abortion people say about you is true. And then I was like, well, wait, maybe all the things the anti-abortion people say about me is true. Like, you know, if you you know, I don't think there's any woman, and, you know, I don't, one thing I definitely don't want to do is speak for all women, but it's hard for me to imagine any woman who has had abortions doesn't have conflicted feelings about it. Like, that seems impossible to me, you know? But I also wanted to raise the question, like, maybe it doesn't have to be the defining, shameful fact of a woman's life either. You know, it's a decision she made under pressure, and as the Turnaway study reveals, 95% of women studied in this 1,000-woman study, 10-year 1,000-woman study, 95% of them said they made the right decision, you know, which is not what the other side will tell you. So in any case, I felt like my best strategy was to tell as much of the truth as I could, because to try to look better than I am, or to try to look less conflicted than I am, or to try to seem more complicated than I am, would make the book didactic. And I didn't want that at all, because I'm always ready to have a conversation. I mean, one of the reasons I'm so excited to go on tour is, like, I want people to push back on me. I want to hear about this, you know? So anyway, yes, I was very open. I tend to do that. My whole process as a writer is to try to find the truth under the truth under the truth. It seems a little more flagrant this time because the subject is so sensitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to follow up on that. The subject's so incredibly sensitive, right? And complicated, to the point where, you know, the just on the political level, the nation's still struggling with this, and it's, you know, it's powerful political forces kind of flowing the other direction now. You know, anti-abortion folks had their great victory with Dobbs, and now the other side looks like they're having victories, you know, pushing back. What do those conversations look like when you talk with people who are, you know, concerned on the other side? that you know, understand that the complications for women, but what about the unborn fetus? That's a big concern of many people.
Yeah, I mean, these conversations, the ones that I've actually had, and the book is just out Tuesday, so I haven't had a lot of the ones I'm going to have yet. But a lot of them concern, you know, this idea of when life begins. You know, that's sort of what the conversations almost always go back to. And of course, in the Jewish faith, generally speaking, of course, this is all generally speaking, because we're all individuals, but life begins at birth. In some other faiths, life begins at conception. Of course, doctors have said repeatedly, the medical establishment believes that life begins at viability outside the womb, which is 24 weeks. Okay, so those are radically different ideas about whether you are, you know, whether you are harming a life or not by having an abortion, you know? And for me, this is in the book, so I can say it because it's now out there, but I had like the one great therapist of my life when I was going through the struggle about what to do, you know, and I was only probably 2 weeks pregnant at the time. And he said, and I said, well, I can't have this baby. And he said, Pam, it's not a baby. It's a cluster of cells the size of a pencil eraser. And that's a phrase I hung on to as I made the decision I felt I had to make at the time, you know, but I also do believe, I mean, I think about Kamala Harris, you know, saying, you know, has there ever been a law in which the Supreme Court made a ruling about what happens inside the male body, you know? And the answer is no. And so, you know, we started this conversation talking about the contradictions and the complications, but, and I guess for me, that wiggle room would be the rights of the fetus after 24 weeks. That's where I fall on that argument. You know, I could be talked into if there's no danger to the life of the mother, and not in the case of rape or incest. I could get behind that fetus at 24 weeks having rights. I could, which is exactly, of course, what Roe gave us. That was the law for 49 years. Before that, I just don't, I've read all the studies and I believe the outcomes for those women who want to terminate a pregnancy are in every case better if they're allowed to make decisions about their own body.
The title of the book is Without Exception. As always with a good title, there's many, you know, many different interpretations there. But one, of course, is ongoing debates in the various states now of should there be exceptions? You know, we have viability of fetus, when abortion should be legal, at what week, et cetera, et cetera. Some states are going absolutist, right? No abortions of any kind. Others are going a different direction. But there's always the argument over exceptions, you know, life of the mother, rape, incest, etc. What do you talk a little bit about that, those debates?
Yeah. I mean, for me, one point I feel no contradictions or complications or confusion about is in the case of rape or incest. Like the idea that people believe that a 12-year-old, like the one we heard from on the stage at the DNC, a 12-year-old who was raped by her father or her stepfather or some other male relative should be forced to carry that child to term and effectively ruin her life is like, that's what some people are pushing for. I didn't write this book out of anger. I'm not angry. I care about women and their lives. I care about the lives of women and girls. But that makes me angry. You know, that's the one point at which I think, what country do I live in? What country do I live in that would make a 10 or a 12-year-old carry her stepfather or her father or her brother's baby to term. I don't want to live in that country.
Well, let's take a brief break. We'll come back. The book is Without Exception, subtitled Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. We're talking with the writer Pam Houston. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Pam Houston. Her latest book from Torrey House Press is Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. So, Pam Houston, you chapter number two is Roe v. Wade, and I think that's important. You know, because for so many years, 50 years, Roe v. Wade's just in the background. It's takes on the status of myth. But you talk about the specifics, and so talk a little bit about what the court actually ruled in Roe v. Wade.
Yeah. Well, the court ruled. So in Roe v. Wade, Jane Roe went to court with a doctor. She was joined in her fight by a doctor who believed the language that an exception could be made to save the mother's life was too vague for doctors to reasonably follow. That was the doctor's argument. And Jane Roe's argument went to court to fight for her right to privacy, which basically translates in Roe to her right to have an abortion without anybody having any say in it. Basically, that's how right to privacy is defined. And what Texas said is that life begins at birth, and they were protecting the life of the fetus. And in Roe, the Supreme Court decided that the U.S. Constitution provides a fundamental right to privacy that protects a person's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion. The court further determined it was not up to the states to decide when life begins. And that way, the national law would be that life begins at viability outside the womb, generally believed to be the 24th week of pregnancy. There's a quote here from the court: "We do not agree that by adopting one theory of life, Texas may override the rights of the pregnant woman that are at stake." Also, what Roe did was divide pregnancy into trimesters. We think that's been true forever, but it was actually Roe that did that, because in the first trimester, it stated women could have abortion under any circumstance. In the second trimester, certain states could make certain restrictions as long as the health of the mother wasn't compromised and as long as it wasn't rape or incest. And then in the third trimester, it gets more murky, and states are able to restrict abortions in certain cases as long as the mother's life isn't threatened. So that was basically what Roe did.
Mm-hmm. So what about Dobbs? Remind us, I think what I understand of it is it puts the decision back to the states. Is that essentially it, Dobbs?
Yes. Dobbs basically canceled the right to privacy and made it so that states could determine what a woman's options were and who was allowed to tell her. I mean, this privacy thing is what makes it tricky, because to explain but yes, I mean, Dobbs effectively killed Roe. And as you probably know, 16 states at the moment Dobbs went into effect had what they call trigger laws on the books, which banned or severely restricted abortion in those states.
Including Utah. Utah's trigger law is still hung up in the courts. I think neighboring Idaho, I think they have a law in place, pretty absolutist in Idaho. And of course, it varies now from state to state. You point out in the book, Pam Houston, that post-Roe, the number of abortions held pretty steady. Didn't increase, right? And in fact, post Dobbs, if anything, number of abortions have gone up. If you're concerned about the number of abortions, you're going to have to try, I guess, something different than Roe or Dobbs. Or, you know, it's It's not reducing the number of abortions.
Right, nor did Roe increase it. It just increased the number of legal abortions, which meant more women lived. And that's something else that I found in the book, maybe the most startling thing I found out in my research in the book, is that the US is 64th in maternal mortality outcomes, 64th best. So in 63 other countries, you are more likely not to die in the process of being pregnant, giving birth, and up to 1 year postpartum. And that's an atrocity. You know, that is truly an atrocity. We Americans spend more money on healthcare than any other nation, and our medical outcomes are abysmal, generally, and especially maternal mortality. And the people who predict these things are predicting those numbers are going to get far worse as Dobbs takes effect in more and more states, and as these trigger laws come out of the courts and start to be enacted, because there will be far more suicides, you know, there will be far more back alley abortions, there will be far more situations that lead to the death of mothers after these laws take effect. And for me, you know, that's the real hypocrisy of all of this pushing for women to have children they don't want to have, is that there's a lot of effort into making sure they have the children they don't want to have, but there's very little effort toward understanding why we have such terrible maternal mortality numbers compared to not just Finland and Iceland and Spain and Italy, but not the Ukraine and Czechia and Turkmenistan. You know, we are so far below so many countries in terms of how we take care of mothers and babies. And you're asking a mother to put her life at risk, or you're telling a mother she has to put her life at risk and go ahead and have that child she doesn't want to, even if she has high blood pressure, even if she has hypertension, even if she has diabetes, even if she has all these other medical conditions that make it more likely that she will die in the process. But we're not addressing the problem of why our maternal mortality numbers are so low.
I imagine you've heard this argument, probably had discussions with people on the other side. I want to present this to you, get your response. You know, I could hear a person, you know, pro-life person saying, yes, stipulate everything you just said. Horrible, horrible problems. But that person might have a concern that some percentage of abortions are still, as they would put it, just a form of contraception, you know, not heading off medical problems, just as they would view it, you know, the just a form of contraception, which is they would see as very, very damaging, if you see the viability of that fetus is quite early, or conception, right?
First of all, I want to take that word pro-life back from you.
Okay, I'm going back. I'm so confused. I'm going back to the old. I don't even know where we are now. But yes, go ahead.
But no, I think that's a problem. You know, I think that's a problem for the people who are fighting for women's rights. You know, they ceded this word life to the other side. You know, like choice is good, but life is better, right? Like, and you know, my question is, whose life? Whose life? You know, the mother's life, the baby's life, who's born into a drug addicted, abusive household, you know, whose life? But in any case, to answer your question, you know, I kind of feel like this idea of abortion as contraception is kind of like this idea about welfare mother. I think this is all language of the right that like isn't as prevalent as anybody thinks. And what really belongs in this conversation is the morning after pill and how you feel about that. The morning after pill is a safe, easy way to terminate a pregnancy that is hours old. You know, and if you really believe that that is a child, then I don't know what to say to you. I just don't. I really don't, because I don't believe that that's a child. You know, this meeting of sperm and egg. I don't feel romantic about it. So that morning after pill saves everybody a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of heartache. And that's another thing, of course, that the right is trying to take away or to restrict access to or to arrest women for traveling across state lines to procure. And like to me, the morning after pill, like I mean, obviously I'm not in this conversation with my own body anymore, you know, but I, you know, to me, the morning after pill is a solution for the reality of mistakes. And when I say mistakes, you know, I don't mean the woman's mistake. I mean the condom breaking. I mean the man saying he had a vasectomy when it wasn't true. I mean a woman, you know, going home with someone she wishes she hadn't. I mean, these are the realities of our modern lives, right? These are the realities of our modern lives. And the morning after pill is a solution. It's a great solution that keeps what you're talking about from happening in probably some huge percentage of the cases when it's available for the woman. But also, I think, you know, there's a whole lot of women who get pregnant, even though they are practicing rigorous birth control. I did 3 times. And, you know, do not need to be held accountable by themselves for that outcome.
Let me change gears a little bit. Have you read, there are some passages here that people will, come expecting a Pam Houston book, right? Do you want to hear about the land and the waxing lyrical about some experiences in nature? You have such a chapter here, Me and the Wild World. I wonder if you'd read a portion of this chapter.
I will. I will. I love the wild world with all of my being. I love the teacup blue color of the largest Great Lake, Superior, also known by its original name, Anishinaabe Gichigami, as it curls and bubbles against the orange cliffs of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. I love galloping a quarter horse up the damp bed of Medino Creek in September, just after the aquifer has sucked the water back down into itself, creating perfect footing for the horse. A flea-bitten gray draft cross warm blood named Big Lil. I love the 700-foot blonde dunes that rise on my left as we move along, the gray granite Sangre de Cristos rising on my right, the willows in the creek bed just on the verge of changing from green to gold, and the sky a sort of stupefying blue that seems to grow deepest twice a year, once now and again in January. I love when it rains on the homestead I have lived on for 30 years, soaking the ground parched from this 20-year and counting drought we continue to endure. Love the smell of wet blue sage. Love how the birds sing so happily when the rain passes, how it quenches the thirst of every plant and animal for miles. Even my parched, aging skin, lips, and hair soak up a little of the moisture. I love the twisted red rock canyons of Escalante in Utah, every color of the sunset and the paintbrush and globe mallow that bursts from between the sandstone's cracks. I love hiking into Calf Creek Falls early on a winter morning, arriving just at the moment the low sun hits the waterfall, turning the beauty up one more notch into sublime, into fairy tale, into a place where no matter how many times I see it, I can't quite believe it's real. All of these places I get to visit each year because my working life takes me there, the working life I chose over a life of raising children. All of these places are also currently threatened by climate collapse, by oil extraction and fracking, by water bottling plants and overuse by four-wheelers and side-by-sides, by politicians who are on the payroll of the extractive industries, by second and third and seventh home ownership, by corruption and land grabs and greed. Here is a thing I have always understood. The same machine that wants wolf puppies to be shot in their dens and rivers to be dammed at their sources and pipelines to be constructed across land that has been sacred to humans for 20,000 years and methane regulations to be loosened and Brazil to be entirely deforested in our lifetime and coal plants to continue to make our air unbreathable and mining companies responsible for toxic spills that poison the soil of the Navajo Nation for generations to come to suffer no consequences. That is the same machine that wants control over women's bodies, the same machine that wants women pregnant and without resources and too overwhelmed to fight for a world in which we can all thrive.
It's Pam Houston reading from her new book, Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. Maybe you could expand on that. You're equating, you know, this extraction and damaging of the earth as the same impulse that wants to control women's bodies.
Yeah. I think it's fear of the unknown. I think a couple things about it. I think it's kind of a colonizer's mentality about ownership. Like, we own this thing. What can we get out of it? How can we use it to contribute to the capitalist machine? But I also think it's fear of the unknown. You know, I think like taming the land and breaking the horse and frack her till she blows. You know, I like all of this language just merges together in my mind about a kind of patriarchal construct that is afraid of mystery and wants it tamed, wants it controlled, you know. And one of the things we've seen in the last 4 weeks since Kamala Harris became the nominee is like all of these women speaking and being joyful and being hopeful and telling their truths. And, you know, it's a force of nature. It really is. And, you know, all the laws we've been hearing about abortion and about women's bodies, but also about how a woman couldn't get a credit card without her husband's permission until whatever date that was. Like, all of these laws are meant to keep that power in check. And I think I think she's called Mother Earth for a reason. You know, the relationship between like the wildness and the power of untamed land and the wildness and the power of untamed females is related. I mean, I feel it every day. It's, you know, and, you know, of course there are, you know, I and it's hard to even talk about this stuff without talking in generalities, but I do think there's a fear of women when they come into their true power in the same way, for instance, in the West, there was a fear of the canyons, you know, I mean, you can hear it in the language, you know, the fear of the slot canyons, you know, it's all so obvious, the connections in this idea to tame and control and then exploit and extract.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with our final segment with Pam Houston. The new book is Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. It's from Tory House Press. Just want to mention a couple of events featuring Pam Houston. So let's see, the 29th, we're at the 27th now, so this is Thursday. Thursday, 1 p.m. in Boulder at Hell's Backbone Grill. There'll be an event and with Pam Houston. And then in October, a couple of more events in Utah. On the 20th of October in Bluff and the 21st in Salt Lake City. So those are some events. Of course, many more events, but those are the ones in Utah. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're spending the hour with writer Pam Houston, and her new book is called Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. It's out from Tory House Press. So, Pam Houston, I was going to have you talk about your mother. In fact, she makes an appearance in this book. I think the chapter is Here She Is Again. We're going to write about her, but we're running out of time, so I'll have people just read about your mother, fascinating character in the book. I want to get to this is a chapter 40 called Confession. And you said in your author's note, this is complicated, right? And a kind of the job of a book is to you know, go deeper, maybe uncomfortably deep, especially for the writer. And so I just want to read this this paragraph. I think of all the hours of my life I've spent hating myself for a plethora of reasons, for not being feminine enough to please my mother, for not being smart enough to please my critical theory teachers, for not being thin enough to please whatever man, for not being clever enough to please my editor, for not being kind enough to my neediest of students, for knowing beyond knowing that I did not want children and making the mistake of getting pregnant over and over and over again. You know, abortion is bound up in this very, very complicated, can have, I guess, lasting after effects. What, you want to talk about, concepts of mercy and grace. What do you talk about that? How you work through this?
Yeah, gosh. Well, I'll tell another story that's in the book, which is that, after I said I was writing this book, I had friends, really good friends, friends who I would have said, we told each other everything, say, oh, well, you know, after my third abortion, blah, blah, blah. Or I really wasn't that freaked out by my second and third one, but I was by my first. And then someone else who said, well, after my fifth, I just realized I was just so fertile and no matter what birth control I used, you know, and all these conversations, you know, I would have said, I told these women everything and they did me, but we had never told each other these things. And I think that's about showing mercy and grace to ourselves, you know, to our own choices and our own predicaments. You know, I believe that we don't have enough mercy and grace in the world, since 2016. And, you know, probably we didn't have enough before that either, but it seems like there's an even greater dearth of it now. And, you know, honestly, my first hope with this book, my first desire for this book is it makes people vote. But my second, almost equal hope is that it gets women to talk to each other with mercy and grace about their own experiences with abortion or not abortion, you know, whatever decision they made, that this doesn't have to be a shameful secret, because secrets are poisonous. And when secrets come into light, you know, you can start to heal from them. So I'm talking about showing mercy and grace to each other and to ourselves.
Just a couple minutes left. I want to have you read one more passage. This is from chapter 60. I imagine many of you picked up this book, et cetera. Read that, just to have about a minute or so left.
I imagine many of you, if you have picked up this book, have had an abortion. And if you did, it is more than likely you were screamed at as you walked in and out of the clinic. Maybe the clinic sent you an email warning you of this in advance. Probably you were called a murderer. Probably the screamers put signs right in your face with unrecognizable piles of bloody pulp on them. Probably they screamed that you were going to hell. Those people have screamed at me one time when I was indeed going to have an abortion, but most times I was just going in for my yearly pap smear, for my regular cancer screenings, for all the stuff a woman has to do if she wants to stay alive. Outside my window tonight, lightning is flashing, rain is pounding the metal roof, and when I wake up tomorrow, the first snow of the year will grace the top of Red Mountain. For the first summer in more than a decade, because of an unusually wet spring, no fires threatened the ranch, and this storm will certainly seal the deal. We had a variety and abundance of wildflowers, flax, bluebells, lupin, penstemon, fleabane, columbine, and every color of paintbrush in the high country we hadn't seen in decades. And the tiny seasonal creek the dogs like to drink out of when we go for our pasture walk thinned in late summer, but for the first time in years, it never failed. I take the time and space to write all of this because it proves to me, and maybe also to you, that the bad thing doesn't always have to happen. What this reminds me is that we are not dead in the water until we decide we are. My most fervent hope is that by compiling this information and telling you as much truth as I know about myself, with all of my contradictions intact, I might help release you from your shame, your fear, your self-imposed bondage. I might help you show yourself mercy. I might help you feel empowered and free.
That is Pam Houston reading from her new book, Without Exception, Reclaiming Abortion, Personhood, and Freedom. We'll end the conversation there. Pam Houston, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Tom. That was great. You're the best interview in the business, I swear.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks for coming on and talking to us. And again, go to Torhouse Press or Pam Houston, pamhouston.net for the events. And there's one coming up on Thursday in Boulder. Pam Houston, thank you so much. And thanks to everyone for listening today. We're going to go out today with one of our new series, Rural Utah at a Crossroads.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities. This interview with Lee Bennett was recorded at the Utah State University campus in Monticello, Utah.
Well, like most people, I started out as a child and managed to make it into adulthood. I have a degree in anthropology and specialized in archaeology, and that is actually why I'm here indirectly. The Forest Service in Idaho picked me up as an archaeologist, and after a few years there, I wanted to move into management, which in the Forest Service means a district ranger. So they transferred me to Monticello because this area has so many archaeological resources, they thought it would be a good fit to have a ranger that knew something about that. So that's why I'm here. I was the first female district ranger in this area. And in the eyes of some people, that meant I denied a man a job that he needed to support his family. And so there was some concern about that. San Juan County struggled economically for most of its existence. Some would argue it still does. For many, many years, for state of Utah, not just for San Juan County, but particularly here, it was livestock and mining that provided the majority of the family-supporting jobs. So those kinds of things are still what people are concerned about losing. In the old days, museums were buying artifacts so people could go out as a family activity and recover artifacts and sell them to a museum and get a little extra spending money. And now, of course, that's not an option anymore. And it's difficult to understand and explain why the difference. And Edge of the Cedars has really helped with that. The two federal agencies here in town were actively engaged in helping the museum become qualified as a federal repository. But it became qualified while I was the district ranger. And I brought back some collections from the U.S. Attorney's Office that had been gathered during law enforcement activities, raids, they're called. I was responsible for bringing some of that back and putting it in the museum where it could be curated and, as the museum sees fit, displayed for the public. And I think that's helped because then people can see the objects and understand more about the stories they tell and not feel that they're totally outside that realm. I think the biggest challenge was the differences of opinion about what the land uses should be. Negotiating through that is a challenge, and basically you'll never make everybody happy. So the buzz phrase when you worked for the government was, if everybody's mad at you, then you're in the right spot. Most of the people that I dealt with, while they may have had strongly held opinions and perhaps generations of background in how and why they felt that way, when you talk to them one-on-one, they were interested in what the different perspective might be. They might not agree with it, but they were willing to listen to it, and vice versa. And so there's just a lot of good-hearted people here who want to do the right thing. The right thing is a moving target, which makes it difficult for both agency and archaeologist and public. But I think it's the people. I have met some very fine individuals, people I probably would not share political perspectives with, or maybe even resource perspectives, but people with whom you can discuss the differences and it doesn't devolve into a fight.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of Rural Utah at a Crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,